I'm Lindsay.
And this is Kathy.
From Kindergarten Kiosk, a proud member of the Education Podcast Network. Just like the show you're listening to right now. The opinions expressed are those of the individual hosts. Make sure you check out all the other great podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com. And get ready because the learning begins in 3, 2, 1.
Hey, today I'm talking with Julia Freeland Fisher. She's the author of Who You Know, Unlocking Innovations That Expand Students' Networks. What an amazing conversation we had today. And I want you to think about this. Could you help kids understand the importance of getting connected in different networks? Well, could you? Yeah, lots to learn today. Thanks for being here. Enjoy.
You are listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast for educators, helping you help kids achieve their dreams. And now here's Steve with this week's show.
Julia Freeland Fisher is the Director of Education Research at the Clayton Christensen Institute. She leads a team that educates policymakers and community leaders on the power of disruptive innovation in the K-12 and higher education spheres through its research. Her team aims to transform education systems into student-centered designs that educate every student successfully and enable each to realize his or her fullest potential. Julia is the author of Who You Know, Unlocking Innovations That Expand Students' Networks, Wiley 2018. The book focuses on emergent tools and practices that leverage technology to radically expand who students know, their stock of social capital, by enhancing their access to and ability to navigate new peer, mentor, and professional networks. Julia has published and spoken extensively on trends in the edtech market, blended learning, competency-based education, and the future of schools. Julia's writing has appeared in outlets including Education Next, Forbes, Entrepreneur, Newer.com, the Chicago Sun-Times, and CNN. Julia holds a bachelor's degree from Princeton University and a JD from Yale Law School. Say hi to everyone, Julia.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, glad you're here, and I appreciate it. We've got you got a cool book here that gets into some really neat stuff that I don't think a lot of adults think about. And so what I'd like to do is, you know, let's talk from this from your bio as we get started. It says this. She leads a team that educates policymakers and community leaders on the power of disruptive innovation in the K-12 and higher education spheres through its research. Can you tell us what disruptive innovation in K-12 is and looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a lot of times when educators hear the word disruptive, they think of that student at the back of the classroom who's taking everyone off task. So the word has some poor connotations in the field of education. But disruptive innovation is a term of art that our founder, Clay Christensen, coined back in the 80s, studying, of all things, the disk drive industry. And what Clay wanted to understand was why seemingly very successful companies suddenly fail and fall victim to upstarts that are competing on new dimensions. And the gist of what he found is that disruptive innovations are innovations that expand access and affordability. They compete on price and over time get better and better and disrupt incumbent companies. So a great example of this from outside of education, Sony's early Walkman, right, was quite unimpressive compared to RCA's tabletop radios. But it was cheap, it was affordable, it was flexible. Teenagers could even afford the Walkman. And over time, as we know, Sony got better and better and disrupted RCA. So that's kind of the process, is the theory of competition. And at the Christensen Institute, we took that theory that was developed in the business world and said, how can we help to explain emerging innovations in the public sector and help to sort of, I like to say, take the trial and error out of innovation happening in education? So rather than just saying, let's try anything new, fingers crossed it succeeds, how can we take that theory and look at what are successful innovations that stand to scale and improve access to high quality education over time?
Very cool. And I got to say something about your example, because I like that story about the Sony Walkman, because having been a kid when all that stuff, a teenager when all that stuff came out, I'll never forget, because I was in band, and on band trips, you saw some of the first kids with these things. And the first ones that I saw had these D-cell battery attachments, and So you actually had the tape player with an attachment next to it. And so you kind of started looking like Batman with a utility belt or something.
Yeah.
And but everybody wanted to borrow it because it was the coolest thing because they all had their – I mean, this side of bringing a boom box with you, this was a neat thing. And it really did change. And then it wasn't too long that those battery packs were gone and the batteries were inside them and it was no longer exactly. The big D-cell. So I could totally see how that – that type of that example is perfect, especially for me.
People of your generation, yes, can really appreciate it.
Go ahead.
It's funny. I mean, I think one of the things when we're looking out and trying to document innovations in the education field, a lot of people get excited about kind of the most state of the art thing. But what you're calling out, right, is that a disruptive innovation at the beginning, it may be exciting, but it may not be sexy at all, right? It may actually look fairly rudimentary compared to the sort of full stack boombox, but it competes on these other dimensions, right? It's more transportable, it's lighter weight, in that case, it's cheaper. And so I think it's an exciting theory to bring to bear in a world that right now I think is very sort of state-of-the-art obsessed to understand, wait, what are the other sorts of innovations that may not look impressive right now, but have true potential to change our world or change our industries over time.
I get it totally. And, you know, it's interesting because just thinking about podcasting is just in itself. I mean, I can have my own show. I can have my own show with very affordable equipment. Whereas, you know, not so very long ago, you had to have an incredible amount of equipment and really there was no access for anything. I mean, it's,
yep.
And now it's all out there. So very cool. So, so who's the prime, let's shift to, who, you know, and so who's the primary target for Who You Know and why is that your target audience?
Yeah, I love this question. And it's also, you know, I'll just be super candid and admit that it's changed as we worked our way through the research and the book, which is probably not something that I would admit to my publisher. But, you know, initially I thought I was writing a book about technology. I wanted to look at what are the technologies we're using to connect students to new relationships with mentors, with experts, with peers. And it kind of morphed into a book about institutional design. And so in that sense, it was really a book written for entrepreneurs in the ed tech market and for school leaders who were enthusiastic about redesigning their schools. Since then, though, by the end of the book, it turned into a book about just the sheer importance of relationships and sort of reminding ourselves of that in the education space and has really broadened to really be a book for anyone working in the education system. And I've had, I know maybe later we'll talk about sort of how this applies to sort of teachers inside of their classrooms today, but I've had great conversations with teachers who got into this work because they cared about relationships, right? And so I'm hoping that some of the research we did is a pathway to get back to that fundamental truth and the importance of brokering relationships for all students.
That's awesome because I can tell you that the sections where you highlight in those chapters about the importance of the relationships and such just really speaks to you. It comes flying out of there. So I think it's funny that that's not really what the original purpose was because it does. Yeah. It does. It hits home with all of that. And so good stuff.
Thank you.
So what I'd like to do is let's kind of get into what it's about because you describe this idea of students' networks. And so what I'd like to do is ask you, you know, what type of networks are you talking about in Who You Know? And could you also explain what we're talking about when you say social capital?
Absolutely, yeah. And networking is kind of a funny word. It's taken on this like schmoozy cocktail hour connotation, right? And I've joked with people that this isn't about turning schools into like mocktail parties for kids. But when we think about a network, one of the things we wanted to get at is like obviously developmental research for decades has shown that caring relationships are crucial to healthy youth development, and anyone working in a school building is sort of hyper aware of that fact. And so we certainly think that a student's network in part is that web of care that hopefully surrounds him or her to support healthy development. But we also wanted to push outwards from that. And if you think about in our adult lives, right, we certainly have close ties with spouses, family, neighbors, friends, but we also have what sociologists refer to as weak ties, those looser acquaintances. And the powerful fact of the matter is that both strong ties and weak ties contain value. And we really wanted to shed light on that in this book, to show that schools should be thinking about shoring up students' access to caring networks, but also about ways they might diversify students' weak tie and acquaintanceship networks. One of the reasons for that, and this is not to say that schools' only purpose is to get kids jobs down the line, but an estimated 50% of jobs come through personal connections. And so if we're thinking about schools as an engine to getting students ready for the labor market, networks become a crucial piece of that opportunity equation. To answer your second question, what the heck is social capital? I sort of inadvertently defined it there, but social capital is just a term of art used in sociology and economics to describe the value contained in a network. So the same way that financial capital has value, that you can go out and buy things with dollars, human capital has values that someone will pay you to do what you know how to do. Whom you know also contains value because our networks provide care, information, and access to opportunity.
I appreciate it. And it is funny because networks has become one of those words that you do think about the parties and talking and trying to figure out your best vocabulary for the day and seeing what
exactly.
You can do.
Exactly. Well, and ironically, so I wrote this book with my husband, and we are both huge introverts. So like the fact that I am willing to talk about networking is super ironic, but it's because I see it as such a crucial piece of access to opportunity that I think schools may understand but may not be designed to optimize for. So
totally understand it. You know, it's funny because just as a side note, I'll never forget when I was an assistant principal in a high school, the principal, who's one of my mentors, I was a discipline assistant principal. All right. And I'm actually out of the pair. I'm the guy who is bad cop. I'm the one that, even though the other guy suspends you too,
the world needs them.
Right. And so what would happen is that, really parents didn't want to see me. I actually at parent night would have people say, "Oh, who are you?" And I'd say, "Oh, I'm Steve Mileto. I'm the assistant principal." Yeah. I know your name. I didn't want to tell me jokingly, but not. He said, "I really don't want to talk to you." And he walked away from me. And so as a result, that kind of gives you a complex. But it was funny because my principal told me, he said, "I need you to be out there talking with parents." And I said, because, you're like, really, they don't want to talk with me. They run the other direction when they realize what my job is. And he's like, no, it's good. And, and it goes back to the same thing with kids, the idea that trying to teach them about the interactions and, basically that idea that you end up, people remember you, that you connect with them, whatever it is, whatever it's over. And there's lot of importance to that. So I'm on that same boat with you as the introvert who I've got to make myself do that. So. But it is.
Well, you've clearly made it work. So.
Well, thanks. But it does add a unique thing to it when they look at you and go, "Wait a second, I've seen your name before." No, I don't want to.
Yeah.
Thanks, man. Okay. Anyway, so what I want to do is I want to take a look. Let's go into into your book in chapter 3, and this is where we start talking about the relationships you were talking about before. In chapter 3, the title of it, I love it. There's no app for that. The power of integrating access to strong ties and care. One of the key takeaways, and I think it's cool, you have a section at the end of it called takeaways, and you say they need strong, reliable, face-to-face ties with caring adults. Can you go into a little bit of detail with this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll cite some research. This is an area where it's quite intuitive, but there's also a fair amount of research out of the youth development space on the importance of caring relationships. And again, like I said, when we started writing this book, it was sort of a book about technology. And so the title of the chapter, "There's No App for That," was us taking very seriously that part of when you think about students' access to networks in the age of social media, in the age of being inundated with technology, is putting technology in its place. And the warning that we wanted to issue is that if we're trying to cram technology in as a tool to replace or act as a surrogate for caring relationships, we are not doing right by young people's healthy development. And so this chapter focuses all on how are schools actually facilitating strong, caring face-to-face relationships? How are they integrating those supports for students? And I think that what the research shows around that is not only do healthy relationships yield healthy development from a health perspective, but they also, these strong relationships, what the Search Institute, an institute that's looked at these relationships over time, can yield are the sorts of outcomes we actually want to see in schools already. So students with healthy developmental relationships show higher grades, more persistence through high school, more likely to go to college. So the sorts of outcomes we're already prioritizing in our education systems, relationships can really yield. The other piece of research that's more recently come out of America's Promise Alliance, which is an organization out of DC that's long been looking at the graduation rate crisis and how to curb that, is that access to a caring adult is one of the key indicators of whether or predictors of whether a student will drop out of school, and one of the key predictors of whether he or she, if he has dropped out, will re-enroll. So adults not only become sort of drivers of the outcomes we want to see, but they're also buffers against risk for students facing adverse circumstances. So again, like this is sort of funny to be lecturing a veteran educator on this because you're like, duh, right? But I think that if you look at the accountability climate of the past two decades in U.S. education, we've forgotten about the way in which relationships can address barriers to learning to get the outcomes we want. We've sort of treated the issue of education and the achievement gap as a purely like we need to just rework academics versus address these factors that surround students and may contribute to their ability to learn and thrive.
That's awesome. And it is something that it's been out there for a while, and I can speak on this at different levels, because that, you know, you see kids all the time, and I don't care what level of student they are. They could be your highest achieving kids to the kids who have the greatest socioeconomic struggles to any and everything in between. All kids need that connection in a building, and it's that connection that they never know when they're going to turn to or never know when they're going to need. And it may be the young man who just needs sees him sitting in the counselor's office for endless days and stops in and says, "Hey, what's going on? I see you sitting in here." And he says, "Oh, they can't work out my schedule." And he steps in and next thing he knows, it's fixed because the teacher volunteers to, to make something work out.
Exactly. And I think a lot of schools right now, to their credit, are aware of this, but were never designed to make that sort of a reliable asset in every student's life. One of the measurement techniques we cite towards the end of the book is a study out of Harvard's Making Caring Common project, where schools have started to put up a roster of all students' names and have every adult in the building put a sticker next to the students' names with whom they feel they have a strong caring relationship. And what that will reveal almost inevitably is that there are students with whom there is no adult who feels that they have that connection with the student. And we need to think about, well, how could we better design schools to make sure that that is more foolproof, to make sure that it may not be every teacher has a close bond with every student, but that we're surrounding all students with a web of caring adults more deliberately.
Yeah, it's awesome, because I've seen it in action. It's just one of those things, because you just never know who's going to connect with you. I mean, I've had, you have kids who they just need that someone, and it may just simply be that they connect with you because they know where you are at a certain time of the day, because that's your duty station. And if you give them time and they come up and they join you in duty and you talk with them and listen to them, it's amazing how that in itself is powerful. So I'm there with you. And it is unfortunate, because too many times what happens is that it's either the kids who who are going to cause the most trouble, or who are at the, at the top of everything, that, they make noise at either end of that spectrum, and they're generally the ones who get all the attention, whereas the ones in the middle can disappear. And and I was someone who worked on that. I was pretty good at disappearing, so I understand that. That comes out, and that's such a neat takeaway in that chapter. And I love the title, because even though you start off as a technology book, I mean, there is no app for being able to have that human interaction, and that's a big part of schools, and being able to focus on that, I think, is important. So
exactly, and I think the other, just to go one level deeper into that title, the other impetus behind that is research from a woman named Sherry Turkle at MIT, who has long sort of bemoaned the decline of empathy in the face of the rise of technology. One of the sort of findings that she often talks about is the fact that it is much harder to form empathy over a technological interface than in a face-to-face interaction. You're not actually operating off the same cues. And so in the spirit of preserving empathy or sort of growing that in our young people, thinking about, okay, how are we making sure that maybe there is going to be an influx of technology in schools. It is going to be a tool to connect, but we're also investing equally in the strength of face-to-face ties.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm going to have to read that. that's good stuff. Because that is one of the biggest problems with some of the technology is that it totally, maybe you figure out, but there's a delay as to what you understand maybe the person is thinking or feeling or whether they're really getting it or not. I've seen that actually happen. So,
yeah. And what the research suggests on that, just to get a little wonky for a second here, the research suggests that the more multimodal the interaction on technology, the more that you're able to build empathy, right? So a text message versus a video chat, you actually are getting more modalities and therefore more cues. And so in some ways, technology is gradually improving, just like that Sony Walkman, right? It's gradually right. improving in a way that could better and better approximate something like empathy, something like that we care about. But we have to pay attention to the fact that right now, many of the tools at our disposal from a technology standpoint aren't doing that and be honest about that.
Gotcha. That's good stuff right there. So let's move on into chapter five. Chapter five talks about making space for relationships. And this sentence comes from there. In fact, many well-intended education policies inadvertently turn schools inside rather than out. Talk about that just a little bit.
Yeah. So one of the phrases we use or that I've now used as I talk about the book is like, what would it mean to build a more networked school? And a part of that is making school more porous with the outside world, both with the immediate community surrounding it and all of the sort of opportunities that may be present in that community. And then even in a more far-flung way, making classrooms more porous to, let's say, experts coming in over video chats and sharing their expertise with students. And one of the barriers we kept sort of hearing about and running into is that the way we have structured school, even with something as sort of simple and maybe seemingly innocuous as, in terms of how we think about credits, has this sort of insular effect. So many states, and I know Georgia has some waivers around this where you are, but many states measure credits in terms of seat time hours. And seat time hours can literally mean the hours a student is spending inside of the school building, right?
Right.
And that makes perfect sense when you're trying to norm around what a credit is and make it transferable into other schools or into the higher education context and make a coherent transcript. But what that ends up doing is saying you can't get credit for things happening outside of school. Or maybe you can get a little bit of independent study credit, but other than that, everything is very fixed in this sort of X number of hours, 180 hours of fill in the blank subject. So that's one example of these policies that were meant to standardize and bring some coherence, actually turning schools sort of inside rather than out. Another set of policies around that, right, are sort of, and you mentioned when we were first getting to know each other before we hopped on this podcast, working at a high school that had tried to sort of create internship models. I think that the temptation to have students only learn from certified educators is very sound if you look at the research that the high quality teacher is the leading predictor of outcomes that we care about. But it's meant that we've closed school systems off from having other people supplement certified educators as also sources of content and knowledge, be that through an internship-based learning program or some of the programs we highlight in the book where you're bringing guest speakers into schools to sort of co-teach alongside teachers and lend their expertise. So again, like those policies, no one set out to say, let's make sure we create an insular environment.
Right.
But the byproduct is that it can be hard for outsiders to fit into our current school designs.
It's an unfortunate aspect, just like you state, because one of the things that it's trying to, you have to have people who are willing to take the time, because that takes time to establish those relationships, to bring people in, to create the program.
To bring people in.
To figure out what's going to work. And then it requires them, sometimes community organizations get focused on money as opposed to them. It's like,
yep.
Your money would be nice, yes, but we actually want you or your staff or somebody from your building. And then it's one of the things you have to survive that I've discovered over time is you have to survive the change in leadership, because if somebody leaves, yeah. then it's quite possible they'll shut down the program or whatever it is that you're trying to do there. But it's just a cool thing because, yeah, trying to bring in, whether it's, you know, any number of different career fields, people. I can remember being in a school where we had a partnership with they were some sort of a chemical company that used chemical engineers, and they created things like paints and dyes and stuff like this. Mm. And they were pretty cool because they were all good in math and very high level math and thinking in a unique way. And it was pretty cool, but then they got bought out by somebody else and we lost all those contacts and cool stuff. But the, not that part, the other part was what was cool.
Yeah. I mean, on that note, on that sort of, surviving cycles of leadership change, right? Because this is all networks, right? Like we're now just talking about sort of the adult networks that could power a more network school model. We mentioned one platform in that chapter, in chapter 5, called Community Share. And I love the story behind it because the founder of Community Share, a guy named Josh Schachter out of Tucson, Arizona, he was a high school teacher who really invested in brokering these sorts of connections for his students and was constantly bringing in guest speakers and really seeing the positive benefits of students having connections to people in their community they otherwise wouldn't meet. And what he observed is that when he stepped back from teaching, when he stepped out of that role, all of those relationships left with him, right? And right. So observing that, he built this platform called Community Share, which the Christian Science Monitor called it Match.com for K-12 classrooms, which I think is an awkward analogy. Josh himself calls it a human library of human books. Other people have thought of it as like a Craigslist for teachers to go on and look for guest speakers. But the idea is building a marketplace model where those relationships can sort of be held and brokered on a platform across a number of teachers and community members, as opposed to it residing with a single individual in his network. And he's gotten great traction in Tucson and is now building out the platform in a couple other geographies along those same lines. So I think that one of the exciting developments we're seeing right now is tools that help us move beyond that all of this lives with one person model, which can be great until it's not. And so we're excited about kind of those platforms that are starting to emerge.
Oh, that's cool, because anything like that is so helpful, because if a school has to start from scratch,
every time someone leaves, yeah.
Right. The likelihood that it's going to survive is not going to be much. But if there is a tool or a notebook that says, here, contact this, and here, take a look at this, and you know, like you said, Craigslist for educators to go through, that's going to more likelihood that it's going to continue through those leadership changes.
Exactly.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you do in your book is you retell and share stories throughout the book. They do an awesome job of making or sharing your point. And for example, I like many, but one that stays with me is the milkshake study. A milkshake is more than a milkshake. I really love this one. Do you have a favorite in the book, or at least one that will always stay with you?
Yeah, that's like such a hard question, not to sound really precious about my own prose.
That's funny.
I think the one that keeps coming up now that I'm sort of talking to real humans and not just sitting in like a research cave by myself is the story of Bear McCreary, who's a very famous composer right now. Has scored stuff like The Walking Dead and Outlander and other like famous shows. And I heard that story actually first on NPR and then got in touch with Bear McCreary's publicist because I loved it so much. And the gist of the story is that Bear McCreary was this young, high schooler musician growing up in a small town in Washington and went to a Rotary luncheon. Where he didn't want to be. And as he tells the story, he's like bored and cocky and he's like, what am I doing here? And he shared a little bit about himself. And afterwards, an older man named Joe Koons came up to him and was like, I think you should meet my friend. And it turns out that this guy, Joe, knew Elmer Bernstein, who's literally like the composer of the last generation. Was literally Bear's sort of idol at the time. And the story is such a, what Bear calls it, he calls it a cosmic coincidence that really changed the course of his life. And I loved it because as a story, it illustrates both how in the world are we leaving these things to chance, right? It is a cosmic coincidence. And on the other hand, the simple fact that a mere luncheon can change the course of a young person's life, right? And so it shows both the what we're leaving to chance and the design choices that could help us take the chance out of those chance encounters. And also his name is Bear, so I love that.
nice.
So anyway, yeah, lots of stories, but I think that one is just such a, we can all picture ourselves in those moments of chance encounter and how they can.
Most definitely. That's so powerful. I heard you tell that story, and it's like, I can only imagine, because I played trumpet for a long time, but yeah, not at any level that is going to get me the attention, but I love music and I know who Elmer Bernstein is, and I would be going, oh my gosh.
Right.
I don't know if you get asked this much, but could I have your autograph?
Exactly.
What do you say to him? Do you say, play something for me? I don't know. It's like, meeting a favorite comedian, say, could you be funny for me?
On command. Yeah.
Yes. That's what an amazing thing for someone to say, I think you need to meet my friend. Yes. What a powerful,
And I think, it's the fame piece of it is like the part that makes the story so nuts. But I think the part of it that I get excited about from a much more like modest standpoint is there's so many latent relationships that could be forged, right? There's sort of this matching game that needs to happen to help young people achieve their potential. And so thinking about that, the incredible possibilities there is the part that gets me excited as a non-musician. I mean, I knew who Elmer Bernstein was, but I probably wouldn't be as excited as you would.
That's so cool. That's so cool, though, because you're so right. The possibility that Mr. Bernstein introduces him to somebody else who ends up connecting
that,
with
that chain reaction.
Right. Yeah. So powerful. Toward the end of Who You Know, this is stated, social connections are also likely to matter more as the future of work rapidly shifts in this age of automation. And I know you've talked a little bit about this. I was just wondering if we could kind of shift towards this, because it does come towards the end of the book, and I was wondering if you could just explain a little bit more about this thought here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we're all reading headlines, it feels like daily right now, about the future of work and these kind of massive macroeconomic shifts that stand to occur over the next generation. And a lot, I will say, I'm a little bit of a skeptic when I read those articles. A lot of statistics get thrown out about all these jobs that we don't know about existing, and there's not a ton of reliable data behind some of those observations. However, a lot of the future of work reports that we've reviewed talk about the importance of networks to allow people to be more nimble in a faster changing economy. So the predictions that you will actually switch jobs more times if you're growing up right now, once you enter the labor market, the predictions that our economy will move in a gig economy direction, where as you're working in a more contractual capacity, you're actually swatting onto numerous projects at a time. And if you think about that kind of architecture of a labor market, a network ends up playing a very important role in being able to be both mobile and to have options. And so I think that's one area that we pointed to in that particular sentence, I think, cites to Deloitte's work on the future of work, which is one of the more kind of comprehensive reports out there. The other thing, I guess you didn't ask this question, but that I want to emphasize when we think about this future, there's the future of work, and then there's also the future of like being human in society, right? So one of the longest running studies on adult development out of Harvard, the Grant and Gluck study, has found that access to warm relationships is like the leading predictor of health and happiness, of longevity and happiness. And so as much as we predict relationships are going to matter for these instrumental purposes to get jobs, to move between jobs, to switch careers, we also think relationships have this enduring importance from just a human development standpoint. And so I think I want to hold those two at the same time in terms of equally important, right? Because this isn't just about how are you getting your next job. It's also about how are you thriving as a human and the role that relationships play in that.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm glad that you went that direction, because that is, I think too often that when people talk about, and in education, it appears in all kinds of forms, from the drive for certain test scores and different, how much technology you're using and measuring that technology's use and so forth, that we forget that human part of this equation, which is the need to have those connections, to talk with people, to be shown how to, it's funny. I used to, as a high school principal, one of the things that I would do for the graduation rehearsals, because I get to, one of the things I loved about being a high school principal is that at graduation, I'm on stage, and when their name gets announced, they walk towards me, they get a big smile, and they get to shake my hand or give me a hug, right? And I would teach them how to shake hands, because I'd say, and it's funny because during practice, we would talk about this, and I said, that's one of the things that, as you start meeting people, you want to work on this. And, for graduation, the point had more to do with, there's a picture going to be made.
Yeah. and for all of time.
Right. And so let's make it look good. All right. And, there's just any number of things with networking and being able to interact with people and being able to talk and have conversation. It's funny. I'm a former officer in the Army, and when you're second lieutenant, they tend to relegate you to like the back table of things, but you're required to go to these functions where all these generals and colonels and stuff like that are going to be, at least they used to, and I don't know if they still do that or not. But, and the funny thing is that you really needed to have someone showing you the ropes to say, you need to interact. Well, come on, let's go meet some of these people. Because otherwise you would say something stupid like I did, which I didn't think about it, but it really made a comment about his age. And it was not where I was going with that. And it was like, and the more we have those types of interactions and we start practicing, because that's what makes us afraid of those interactions, is that we're going to put our foot in our mouth and say something really dumb. And, and I've had those situations any number of times. Right now, there's probably a lot of people who know me going, yeah, you're right, you have. but I think the more we get those opportunities to have that personal interaction, the better to be able to connect, to find, and to say, to call up. But I don't know if you remember me or not, we met one time, and I was just wondering if you might be able to help me with whatever this thing is that I'm working on, or I'm looking to make this transition. And I was wondering if I remember you being such a great speaker. I was wondering if you might be able to help me with some thoughts, that type of thing.
Yeah. Well, and I think you've just articulated, I don't want to even call this attention, but something that I think in the education conversation right now needs to be bridged, because you started out talking about the skill sets of networking and how to not, make an ass of yourself in front of your, generals or what have you, right. In the chain of command or whatever. But then you also talked about opportunity and access, and we didn't want to just write a book about the skill set of networking, because the reality is the data shows that there's unequal access to networks right now among young people. And if we don't design schools to expand that access alongside building these soft skills, right, we're still going to see opportunity gaps. And to your point, we can practice networking all we want, but if I come up across a problem and I don't know anyone to go to mobilize, to activate, to solve that problem, I'm sort of out of luck. So I think, you'll notice, well, you may not have noticed, but I noticed that we do not use the phrase social emotional learning a single time in this book, which is absurd given that it's a book about social capital and networks and all that. But it's partly because I think we have to have an access conversation, an access to opportunity conversation in tandem with that skill set conversation. And I don't think that's happening enough. But anyway, so I felt like you beautifully articulated kind of the arc of how we've thought about this as both a skill and an access play.
Very cool. Well, thank you. And it's such a neat thing what you're talking about, because first of all, I could never come up with the words you just used, but the but I do understand that, and it's one of those things that it's just like in teaching and in education, you have to have, not only do you want to teach teachers in interacting with kids about this. I spend time teaching teachers and future administrators about the same sort of thing, that you want to start delving into these different networks and starting to make access to people who are in them, who can help you get and do what you want. And
get by and get ahead is the phrase that we use.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. What I'd like to do as we're coming to a close is, do you have some, favorite section of the book or a chapter or just some part that you wish that everybody would read again and again and again?
Yeah, that's like such an awkward question because I'm like, I'm amazed that people are reading once, so I'm not going to tell people to read again and again. But I will say, you know, like I said, this book went through many iterations, and I had the privilege of working on it with my husband, which was this like insane but awesome endeavor. And I think the conclusion, as cheesy as it sounds, feels the most authentic to me and to my husband as writers. Like, we got to that point and we got to sort of wrap it all up and not use technical terms as much and make it less about sort of like the how and really come back to the why relationships matter and why they stand to continue to have this like enduring importance in our lives. And so the conclusion is quite short. So that's the other reason I'm saying read it again and again. But I think it hopefully resonates with people in why this we think stands to continue to be incredibly important for the opportunity equation and for all students.
Very cool. So why should a teacher or school administrator read Who You Know?
Yeah, I mean, I think hopefully for teachers and school administrators, the book offers both a glimpse into the research on social networks, which is sometimes missing, I think, from the traditional curriculum in a teacher prep program. So a glimpse into that research and then an understanding of the emerging school models that are really investing in students' networks in meaningful ways. So I think it's a mix of a why and a how-to, hopefully, that could inspire the next generation of leaders to really design schools with this in mind.
Well, I got to tell you, it's an awesome book, and I would encourage teachers and school administrators to read it because it does make you think about the opportunities that you might have to share with kids. How to get into those networks and share with them your skills or introduce them to people who have other skills and skill areas that they can take advantage of.
Yeah, and related to that, I mean, I guess one hope if some of the predictions in this book come to roost is that I talk to a lot of teachers where their profession feels incredibly lonely. Like they are the sole source of a student's network in
yes.
their classroom.
Yes.
And I do think we could design schools so that teachers aren't going it alone. And that is a whole other maybe book, but it's part of what we had in mind when we thought about teachers that are pulling in these different tools and bringing in guest speakers and allowing their students to broker new connections is that teachers don't have to be the sole conduit to social capital in students' lives. There could be other people involved in that project down the line.
That's awesome. And I can tell you that one of the tools that has been that for me has been podcasting. And
yeah.
It does open that world up and make you realize we're not alone. So,
yeah.
Which is cool. So if someone wanted to connect further with you, where would you send them?
Sure. Well, so my email, I live on email. So jfreeland@christiansoninstitute.org. And I'm also on Twitter at Julia F. Freeland. And the Christiansen Institute, which our website I just named christiansoninstitute.org, also has a weekly newsletter that I'd encourage people to sign up for, which will have sort of the latest in this research and all of our other research into innovations in education and sort of that next frontier.
Excellent. And I'll have those in the show notes. Which people can go to and find out and reach out and connect with you. So I got two questions, and here we go. The last two questions.
Great.
If you were given the chance to talk with 100 brand new teachers who haven't started teaching yet, what advice would you give them?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think get to know your students. And that sounds really obvious, but I think, again, partly because of the accountability climate, we sometimes try and short-circuit the relationship piece, even though research shows that the better teachers know their students, the better they're able to differentiate instruction down to the individual, which we know leads to better results. So I think that's number one. And then number two, think about your classroom as a potentially more open ecosystem. Think about how you could start to pull outsiders in who, again, could spark engagement among your students and sort of share the project of educating students with you. So I think those would be two little nuggets of, I don't want to call it wisdom or advice, just ideas.
Great ideas. So good stuff. So last question, do you have a teacher in your past who made a difference in your life? If given a chance to say thank you, who would it be and what would you say?
Yeah, so unambiguously, this would be my high school English teacher, John Foggi, who, when I came into high school, I had written, you know, a 5-paragraph essay where, like, dreams went to die. I was not a writer at all. And what was so incredible about him was that he had the patience and the, like, just sheer endurance to provide all of us with, like, really meaty line edits on our essays, time and time and time again. And it was that sort of deliberate practice for me that took me from a student who dreaded writing to one who went on to major in comparative literature and, like, totally in in an act of total surprise, like, actually write a book, right? And take pleasure in that. So I think definitely John Foggi for the sort of constant feedback and willingness to edit my less than perfect prose.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, Julia, thank you so much for sharing Who You Know, Unlocking Innovations that Expand Students' Networks. It's thought-provoking and brings to light something that can make a difference, but generally is lost in our daily lives in schools. And I thank you, and I wish you the very best.
Thank you so much, Steve. It was a pleasure.
Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is excited to be a member of Voice Ed Radio. Voice Ed Radio, your voice is right here. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a proud member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. The opinions expressed on Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 are those of the guests and hosts. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions for classroom teachers and school administrators. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll share it with your friends.